Chapter 5. The droning of the twin-engine C-47 drowned out all casual conversations between the men sitting on the bench seats along the side of the plane. Private Sean Cooper sat across from his buddy Private Lassiter Moore. Moore chewed gum and looked relaxed. Sean doubted he looked even half as calm. He'd trained long and hard for this moment, and now that it was finally upon him, he didn't know if he could follow through with it. Any second now, Sergeant Willits would send them out the door and into space with nothing but a wispy, thin silk canopy to slow them down. The light beside Willits's head suddenly glowed red. Willits checked his wristwatch, cupped his hands over his mouth, and bellowed, "Three more minutes!" Sean tightened the strap, holding the helmet on his head. Lassiter smacked his gum and gave him a thumbs-up sign. Sean returned the gesture, but felt anything but ready. He couldn't stop thinking about the stories he'd heard of soldiers' parachutes not opening correctly, or at all. Most had kept their wits and pulled their reserve chutes in time to avoid pancaking into the ground, but not all of them. He'd packed his own chute for this jump, and knew he'd done it correctly, but sometimes things went wrong. He knew the math. From 1,000 feet, he'd only have about 8 seconds to pull the reserve chute, not a lot of time to figure out if he even needed the reserve chute. The instructors assured them they'd know, but this would be his first jump. How could he know?
"Get ready!"
barked Sergeant Willits. Sean reacted instantly, even though he couldn't believe how fast the time had passed. He took the static line fastener in his right hand, ready to hook it to the metal cable running the length of the plane.
"Stand up!"
Willits yelled. Sean stood and faced the back of the airplane, his left hand holding the overhead cable.
"Hook up!"
Sean snapped the fastener onto the cable and pulled hard. He inserted the cotter pin into the safety button on the fastener, assuring it couldn't come loose.
"Check equipment!"
Sean checked his own equipment carefully, going through the process that they'd pounded into their heads. Then he checked the man in front of him, Private Moore, while the man behind Sean checked him out.
"Sound off for equipment check!"
From the back of the stick, Collins yelled, "12, okay!" The men called out their readiness, and when they'd all done it, the jumpmaster yelled,
"Everybody happy?"
In perfect unison, Sean and the other 11 men yelled at the top of their lungs,
"Yes!"
Moore turned and mouthed, "This is it," then turned away. He actually looked excited. Sean felt fear building in his guts. He concentrated on the back of Moore's head. He rehearsed what he'd do. When the light turned green and the sergeant gave the order, he'd simply shuffle his way forward right beside Moore. After Moore jumped, it would be his turn. Since it was their first jump, they wouldn't file out one after another. Each man would stand in the door and wait for Willits's signal. Refusal to jump would disqualify them from the unit immediately, and the many months of hardship leading up to this moment would all be for nothing. Sean couldn't imagine how awful that would be. He'd never been a part of anything that gave him as much pride or purpose as the airborne. He loved it, and even if they never saw combat, they thought of themselves as elite soldiers. They jumped out of perfectly good airplanes, for crying out loud. He loved that attitude. He'd heard all the stories of guys that had failed to jump. None of them thought it would happen to them, but once they stood there, something deep inside their psyche wouldn't allow them to make the final push out the door. He wondered if they'd felt the same fear he felt growing inside himself right now.
"Stand in the door!"
Willits yelled to Lieutenant Hennessy. Hennessy stood in the door and the line moved forward a few feet. The light turned green.
"Go!"
Hennessy leaped out, and the next man moved into position.
"Go!"
Every few seconds, soldiers threw themselves into the prop blast. Suddenly, the gaping door faced Sean. Moore had jumped without him even noticing. Sean stepped to the edge of the door, placing the ball of his left foot on the edge of the door so his toes and his jump boots hung in space. With hands gripping the sides of the door, he looked straight ahead, waiting for the touch on his leg, which would send him hurtling. He wanted to look down, but he kept his eyes on the distant horizon the way they'd trained him to do. Willits tapped his leg and yelled,
"Go!"
Without a second thought, Sean stepped into space and pivoted. He immediately tucked his chin to his chest so the buckle from the risers wouldn't knock him out when the chute opened. He counted out loud, and when he counted three, he felt a sudden, violent tug as the 50-foot pull cord reached the end of the tether and yanked the metal rod from the top of the parachute bag, allowing the chute and the risers to unwind and snap open. Despite all the training, the jolt of the real thing made him grunt in pain and surprise. He looked up and saw a wide-open canopy. Giddiness replaced his fear. He looked at the view for the first time. All around him, parachutes floated down like pear blossoms. He heard some whoops of joy and felt his own whoop erupt from the depths of his soul. He'd done it! He'd jumped! The adrenaline coursing through his veins felt unlike anything he'd ever felt before. Far too quickly, the ground approached, and, once again, his training took over. His knees and hips absorbed the fall, and he rolled sideways. A slight breeze kept the canopy inflated, and he felt himself being dragged. He trained for this, too. He rolled to his feet and ran to the side of the chute. The risers lost tension, and the canopy deflated just like it was supposed to. He wrapped the parachute and took a moment to watch the rest of the stick come in for landings. Pride swelled in his chest, and he knew he never wanted to leave the airborne. Sean painstakingly packed his own chute under the rigger's watchful eyes. The mood inside the rigger warehouse bordered on giddy. When they were done, Sean, along with the rest of his company, jogged back through the center of Fort Benning with their heads held high. They sang a bawdy cadence song led by Sergeant Mayhew. Their voices rang louder and exuded more confidence than normal, and other formations they passed turned to watch. In the mess hall line, Private Moore elbowed Sean. "A few more jumps and we'll earn our jump wings. We're so close now!" Sean couldn't keep the excitement from his voice. "It doesn't seem possible. We actually jumped out of an airplane!" Moore laughed and slapped his back. "Willingly! Before last week, I'd never even been in one, and now I've flown in two and jumped out of one!" "Same here. I can't wait to do it again. What a feeling!" Moore lowered his voice a little. "You hear about Calhoun and Blanche?" "What about them?" Sean asked with some concern. "They couldn't do it. They're already gone." Sean pictured them in his head. Both men were exceptional athletes and always finished near the top of any exercises the training cadre put them through. "I wouldn't have bet on losing those two." "Just goes to show, it's all in your head." "Mind over matter," Sean agreed.
"I loved it," Moore beamed. "I can't wait to do it again." "Me too. Definitely never felt anything even close." "Imagine doing that with Germans shooting at us."
Sean suddenly felt a shot of fear. He swallowed and it quickly passed. He said, "I'm not sure that's a good topic right before chow." Moore guffawed.
"What do you think they're training us to do?"
Sean shrugged as a cook scooped a load of mashed potatoes onto his plate.
"You really think we'll parachute into combat?" Sean asked.
Moore looked at him as though he'd lost his mind.
"Of course! That's what this is all about, genius!"
Two slabs of buttered white bread plopped beside the potatoes.
"I guess you're right. Just seems kind of surreal to think about." "Where you think we'll be sent?" Moore asked.
Before he could answer, Moore said, "I think we'll head to France. That makes the most sense."
"What about the Japanese? Maybe they'll send us to the Pacific." "Yeah, maybe."
Moore shook his head as a thick cut of meatloaf landed on his plate.
"But I think the Marines will take care of them."
They moved out of line and found a place to sit among their company. Young soldiers wolfed down their food like starving dogs. Between swallows, Sean said, "I've got a cousin in the Philippines." Moore wiped his mouth with his napkin.
"I'd forgotten about that. Have you heard from him?"
"Nah. The reports aren't good, though."
"You can say that again. From what I hear, those little yellow bastards are rolling over everything in their path."
He shoved a piece of meatloaf into his mouth and talked around it.
"It's so far away. Hard to think about."
"I hope he's okay."
"Hell, maybe we'll jump there and save the day."
He held up his hands as though describing a marquee.
Cousin Cooper comes to the rescue. Headline news.
Sean smiled at the happy thought, but knew it unlikely. I hope they can hold out that long. Moore downed half his milk and said,
There are a lot of soldiers over there, and I'm sure help's already on the way.
The Japs decimated our navy at Pearl. Where's the help going to come from?
Moore stopped, his fork halfway to his mouth, considering. He finally shrugged and said,
I don't know, but they won't just leave them out there to die. Our guys are better soldiers anyway. They'll probably beat them back on their own. The Marines are there too, you know, and...
He looked around and lowered his voice.
They're tough sons of bitches. Crazy, but tough.
Sean laughed.
We jump out of airplanes, and you're calling them crazy?
Moore held up his milk glass and a toast and said,
Geronimo!
A few soldiers repeated the word, which had become a rallying call when jumping from the plane. However, they weren't fully qualified paratroopers yet and didn't want to offend or assume, so they kept their voices low. Corporal Frank Cooper watched the last vestiges of evening light give way to darkness. He hated the nights. Before the Japanese invasion, the opposite had been true. When the sun went down, the temperature mercifully went down with it. But now the night only brought death and terror. He stood in his foxhole with his Thompson propped and faced toward the churned-up ground. It used to be a lush jungle, but the constant bombing and artillery fire turned it into a plowed field. He touched his ammo pouch and adjusted it for quicker access. He wished he had grenades, but he'd thrown his last one the night before. It didn't matter, though. Most of them turned out to be duds anyway. The moist air wreaked havoc on any kind of fuse or mechanism out here, and they'd sat in damp warehouses for months, and sometimes years, before finally being used. From the bottom of the foxhole, Private First Class Russo asked, You sure you're okay taking first watch?
For the last time, yes. What is it with you?
Russo, a big kid from some tiny ranch town in Montana, shifted. I'm hungry. Probably won't be able to sleep none anyway.
If you fall asleep, you won't have to worry about your damn stomach anymore. Shut your eyes and shut up.
Russo sighed and murmured, Don't have to bite my head off, Corporal. Frank ignored him and kept watching the darkness. Russo was right. Frank's attitude since the Japanese attack had gotten worse and worse.
He knew it, but what could he do? Their situation stank to high heaven and it pissed him off.
Every day, their ammo supply dwindled. He'd heard less and less friendly artillery fire. Every time he begged for more ammunition, he got the same answer. You'll get more ammo when we get more ammo. In other words, you're shit out of luck. Rations had been cut in half, too. He'd already had to tighten his belt a few notches to keep his pants from falling down. He felt the pang of hunger all the time. For a big guy like Russo, it would be an even harder adjustment. But the thing that pissed him off the most wasn't the lack of supplies, but the lack of cohesion. No one seemed to know the complete picture. No one seemed in charge. When the Japanese attacked, they attacked in well-organized units. They fought like tigers, too. All the bullshit he'd heard about the Japanese being inferior soldiers was just that. Bullshit. In contrast, the Allies fought singly and ineffectually. As a corporal, even he knew their lines were dangerously thin. Every time the Japanese made a concerted attack, the same thing happened. Most of the lines held, but the Japanese would invariably find the weak point, break through, and the Allies would be forced to retreat or risk being encircled and wiped out. Frank hated to lose, but so far, that's all they'd been doing. An hour later, he hunkered, hearing the familiar thumping sound of firing mortar rounds. By now, everyone knew the sound, and they knew what it meant. A Japanese attack. The Japanese normally waited until the wee hours of the night, but not tonight, apparently. He kicked the softly snoring Russo. He had to kick him two more times before he finally woke up and grumbled, Is it time already? The thump of an exploding mortar shell brought him to his feet. Frank said, It's only been an hour, but they ain't waiting around tonight. They both hunkered just beneath the lip of the foxhole. The Japanese wouldn't attack until the barrage lifted. Russo's gut gurgled loudly, and he rubbed his empty stomach. "Drink some water. It'll help," Frank suggested. Russo unclipped his canteen and took a slug of the halazone-laced liquid. He offered it to Frank, but he waved it away. Frank dug into his pant pocket and pulled out what looked like a small brick. He gnawed on a corner until the chalky, chocolate-like substance finally broke off. He chewed and offered it to Russo. Russo took the D-ration gratefully and gnawed off a chunk. He handed it back as dirt rained down on their steel helmets. The brief mortar barrage stopped, and someone up the line yelled, "Here they come!" Frank raised his head until he could peek over the lip. In the darkness, he saw winking muzzle flashes. He pulled a Thompson up and propped it on the piece of wood he'd put in place. He didn't see any shapes, just muzzle flashes and yelling. He looked to either side, seeing the silhouettes of other GIs, similarly prepared. He heard NCOs yelling out to the men, telling them to hold fast and keep sharp. Frank raised his voice and said, "Conserve your ammo! Make every shot count!" A few weeks ago, the men would have already started firing at the distant muzzle flashes, but they'd learned to conserve and fight lean. Sergeant Gunnison, the platoon sergeant, bellowed, "Fix bayonets!" "Shit!" Frank cursed. He must have heard from the OPs. He pulled his bayonet from his belt and stuck it into the dirt beside him. His Thompson didn't have an attachment point. If it came down to hand-to-hand fighting, he'd use the knife barehanded. Russo attached the bayonet to his Springfield. He took in a deep breath and blew it out slowly. "Hate this shit, Corporal," he muttered. "No shit." Frank pointed left and ordered, "You take anything to the left of this line, and I'll take anything directly in front and to the right. Got it?" "Got it." Frank settled into the stock and looked over the sights. Bullets whipped overhead, and a few smacked the mud between the foxholes, but he kept aiming. They couldn't possibly see where they were until they opened fire themselves. Flares erupted overhead, and Frank shut one eye, attempting to maintain his vision. The flares sputtered and danced overhead, casting bizarre shadows across the hellscape. He could see the enemy now. Japanese soldiers trotted forward between the bomb craters. He centered his sights on the nearest man, but pulled off him when he saw a better target just beyond him, a soldier holding a sword. A few seconds later, the stuttering of four water-cooled 30-caliber machine guns opened fire. The gouts of muzzle flame shot out from their protective bunker slits and added to the light from the flares. A few GIs fired, but most waited half a beat to see the effects of the machine guns. The Japanese officer in Frank's sights dove for cover. Frank kept aiming in the general area, hoping he'd poke his head back up. The initial onslaught of lead cut a large swath through the Japanese soldiers, but most dropped into bomb craters, waiting for the machine guns to reload or jam. The machine gun fire finally tapered off, and Frank saw the Japanese officer raise his head and his sword. He called out to his men and stood. Frank could barely hear him over the din of rifle and machine gun fire. When the officer took his first step, Frank pulled the trigger and sent a single slug downrange. The officer stumbled but kept coming. Frank adjusted and fired again. This time, the officer fell face down and didn't get up. Beside him, Russo fired methodically. He burned through his five rounds and sank into the hole. "Reloading!" he yelled. Frank shifted aim and found another soldier sprinting past the officer's body. He ran hunched over. Frank put his sights low on center mass and fired a short burst. He thought he must have hit him, but he saw no effect. He adjusted and fired again. Frank's bullet smashed into the soldier's leg, and he fell as though a carpet had been pulled from beneath his feet. Frank could hear him screaming in agony. He traversed his muzzle and fired a longer burst into another charging soldier. His target dropped, but Frank didn't watch to see if he stayed down. "Reloading," he said as he dropped below the lip of the hole and pulled out another magazine. He pushed it into the breech and worked the bolt. Smoke snaked from the muzzle, and the sounds and smells of battle overwhelmed his senses. Just as Frank rose, Russo dropped back down to reload again. "Go easy on the ammo," Frank reminded him. "They're everywhere," Russo said, his voice taking on a hint of panic. Frank immediately found more targets. A group of three soldiers wove through their dead and dying comrades. He centered his sights on the middleman, but before he could fire, a machine gun stitched all three with lethal fire. They dropped and shook with bullet impacts. That seemed to break the attack, at least at this spot. He didn't see more charging soldiers, but lots of muzzles poked up from bomb craters and from behind felled palm trees. Bullets smacked the ground in front of him, sending dirt into his eyes. "Ah, shit," he cursed. Russo took his eyes from his sights quickly and asked, "Are you hit?" "No." Frank dropped into the hole and scraped the dirt from his eyes as best he could. "Dirt in my eyes. I can't see." Russo fired twice, then dropped beside him. He clutched Frank's face in his hands. He tried to scrape the dirt away, but Frank protested, "Ow! Damn it! Knock it off! Use water!" Russo pulled his canteen and poured the contents over Frank's eyes. Frank tilted his head back and felt immediate relief. "Thanks. I'm okay now." He pushed him away. "Get back up there!" Frank rose and fired methodically. Frank gave one final shake of his head to clear the dirt. Russo suddenly dropped back into the hole. Frank scolded him. "You're going through ammo too fast, Russo!" Russo didn't answer, and his body spasmed unnaturally. "Russo!" Frank spun him around. The back of his head dripped brains, blood, and bone. A small hole in the center of the bridge of his nose streamed blood. "Russo! No!" Rage filled him, and he rose and sighted over his submachine gun. He saw the distinctive shape of a pith helmet poking up from a fallen palm tree. Bullets snapped past Frank's hole. He centered his sights and pulled the trigger. He fought to keep the muzzle from rising. The helmet flung into the air and the Japanese soldier beneath it dropped out of sight. He desperately searched for more targets. Artillery shells screeched in and exploded along the line, shaking the earth like a giant angry toddler with a new toy. Frank stayed up, knowing the Japanese would use the barrage to escape. Dirt and debris sprinkled his helmet. Bits of shrapnel zinged past him, making bizarre sounds, but he stayed on his sights. Finally, Japanese soldiers rose and sprinted back the way they'd come. He fired the rest of his rounds, but doubted he'd hit any of the fleeing men. Anger and frustration overcame him, and he screamed at their retreating backs, "Get back here, you bastards!" Breathing hard, he sank back into the hole and stared at Russo's dead eyes. "At least he won't complain about being hungry anymore," he thought. And he wondered at his own callousness.